In the morning she proudly displayed the treasures she had brought for him in her saddlebags. She had somehow procured everything he had asked for in the notes he had left for Aberley in the wall of the castle. He snatched up the charts. "Where did you get these from, Sukina?" he demanded, and she was delighted to see how much value he placed upon them. "I have many friends in the colony," she explained. "Even some of the whores from the taverns came to me to treat their ailments. Dr. Saar kills more of his patients than he saves. Some of the tavern ladies go aboard the ships in the bay to do their business, and come back with divers things, not all of them gifts from the seamen." She laughed merrily. "If something is not bolted to the deck of a galleon, they think it belongs to them. When I asked for charts, these are what they brought me. Are they what you wanted, Gundwani?" "These are more than I ever hoped for, Sukina. This one is valuable, and so is this." The charts were obviously some navigator's treasures, highly detailed, and covered with notations and observations in a well-formed, educated hand. They showed the coasts of southern Africa in wondrous detail, and from his own knowledge he could see how accurate they were. To his amazement, the location of Elephant Lagoon was marked on one, the first time he had ever seen it shown on any chart other than his father's. The position was accurate to within a few minutes of angle, and in the margin there was a sketch of the landfall and seaward elevation of the heads, which he recognised instantly as having been drawn from observation. Although the coast and the immediate littoral were accurately recorded, the interior, as usual, had been left blank or filled with conjecture, apocryphal lakes and mountains that no eye ever beheld. The outline of the mountains in which they were now sequestered was sketched in, as though the cartographer had observed them from the colony of Good Hope or from sailing into False Bay and had guessed their shape and extent. Somewhere, somehow, Sukina had found him a Dutch mariner's almanac to go with the charts. It had been published in Amsterdam and listed the movements of the heavenly bodies until the end of the decade. Hal laid aside these precious documents and took up the backstaff Sukina had found. It was a collapsible model, whose separate parts fitted into a small leather case, the interior of which was lined with blue velvet. The instrument itself was of extraordinarily fine workmanship. The bronze quadrant, decorated with embodiments of the four winds, needles and screws, were all engraved and worked in pleasing artistic shapes and classical figures. A tiny bronze plaque inside the lid of the case was engraved, Cellini, Venezia. The compass she had brought was contained in a sturdy leather case. The body was brass, and the magnetic needle was tipped with gold and ivory, so finely balanced that it swung unerringly into the north as he rotated the case slowly in his hand. "These are worth £20 at least," Hal marvelled. "You're a magician to have conjured them up." He took her hand and led her outside, not limping as awkwardly as he had on the previous day. Seated side by side on the mountain slope, he showed her how to observe the noon passage of the sun and to mark their position on one of the charts. She delighted in the pleasure she had given him, and impressed him with her immediate grasp of the esoteric arts of navigation. Then he remembered that she was an astrologer and that she understood the heavens. With these instruments in his hands, he could move with authority through the savage wilderness, and his dream of finding a ship began to seem less forlorn than it had only a day before. He drew her to his chest, kissed her, and she merged herself tenderly to him. "That kiss is a better reward than the £20 of which you spoke, my captain. If one kiss is worth £20, then I have aught for you that must be worth 500, he said, laid her back in the grass, and made love to her. A long time later she smiled up at him and whispered, "That was worth all the gold in this world." When they returned to the encampment, they found that Daniel had assembled all the weapons, and that Aberley was polishing the sword blades and sharpening the edges with a fine-grained stone he had picked from the stream bed. Hal went carefully over the collection. There were cutlasses enough to arm every man, and pistols too. However, there were only 5 muskets, all standard Dutch military models, heavy and robust. Their lack was in powder, slow match, and lead ball. They could always use pebbles as missiles, but there was no substitute for black powder. They had less than 5 pounds weight of this precious substance in the flasks, not enough for 20 discharges. "Without powder we can no longer kill the larger game," Saba told Hal. We eat partridges and dassies. He used the diminutive of the Dutch name for badger, Dusk, to describe the fluffy, rabbity creatures that swarmed in the caves and crevices of every cliff. Hal thought he recognized them as the conies of the Bible. The urine from the dassie colonies poured down the cliff face so copiously that as it dried it covered the rock with a thick coating that shone in the sunlight like toffee, but smelt less sweet. With care and skill, these rock rabbits could be killed and trapped in such numbers as to provide the little band with a staple of survival. Their flesh was succulent and delicious as suckling pig. Now that Sukino was with them, their diet was much expanded by her knowledge of edible roots and plants. Each day, Hal went out with her to carry her basket as she foraged along the slope. As his leg grew stronger, they ventured further and stayed out in the wilderness a little longer each day. The mountains seemed to enfold them in their grandeur and to provide the perfect setting for the bright jewel of their love. When Sukina's foraging basket was filled to overflowing, they found hidden pools in the numerous streams in which to bathe naked together. Afterwards they lay side by side on the smooth, water-polished rocks and dried themselves in the sun. With tantalizing slowness they toyed with each other's bodies and at last made love. Then they talked and explored each other's minds as intimately as they had explored their bodies, and afterwards made love yet again. Their appetites for each other seemed insatiable. "Oh, where did you learn to please a girl so?" Sukina asked breathlessly. "Who taught you all these special things that you do to me?"
It was not a question he cared to answer, and he said, "It is simply that we fit together so perfectly. My special places were made to touch your special places. I seek pleasure in your pleasure. My pleasure is increased 100-fold by yours."
In the evenings, when all the fugitives gathered around the cooking fire, they pressed Hal with questions about his plans for them, but he avoided these with an easy laugh or a shake of his head. The plan of action was indeed germinating in his mind, but it was not yet ready to be disclosed, and there were still many obstacles he had to circumvent. Instead, he questioned Saba and the five escaped slaves who, with him, had survived the mountain winter. "How far to the east have you travelled across the range, Saba?"
"In midwinter we travelled 6 days in that direction. We were trying to find food and a place where the cold was not so fierce."
"What land lies to the east?"
"It is mountains such as these for many leagues.
And then suddenly they fall away into plains of forest and rolling grassland with glimpses of the sea on the right hand."
Saba took up a twig and began to draw in the dust beside the fire. Hal memorized his descriptions, questioning him assiduously, urging him to recall every detail of what he had seen.
"Did you descend into these plains?"
"We went down a little way. We found strange creatures, never before seen by the eyes of man, grey and enormous, with long horns set upon their noses. One rushed upon us with terrible snorts and whistles. Though we fired our muskets at it, it came on and impaled the wife of Johannes upon its nose horn and killed her."
They all looked at little one-eyed Johannes, one of Saba's band of escaped slaves, who wept at the memory of his dead woman. It was strange to see tears squeezing out of his empty eye socket. They were all silent for a while. Then Swanchi took up the story. "My little Bobby was only a month old, and I could not place him in such danger. Without powder for the muskets, we could not go on. I prevailed on Saba to turn back, and we returned to this place."
"Why do you ask these questions? What is your plan, Captain?"
Big Daniel wanted to know.
But Hal shook his head. "I am not ready to explain it to you, but don't lose heart, lads. I have promised to find you a ship, have I not?" he said, with more confidence than he felt. In the morning, on the pretense of fishing, he led Abberley and Big Daniel up the stream to the next pool. When they were out of sight of the camp, they sat close together on the rocky bank.
"It is clear that unless we can better arm ourselves, we are trapped in these mountains. We will perish as slowly and despondently as most of Saba's men already have. We must have powder for the muskets."
"Where will we get that?" Daniel asked. "What do you propose?"
"I have been thinking about the colony," Hal told them. Both men stared at him in disbelief. Abberley broke the silence.
"You plan to go back to Good Hope?" Even there you will not be able to lay your hands on powder. Oh, perhaps you might steal a pound or two from the green jackets at the bridge, or from a company hunter, but that is not enough to see us on our journey.
I plan to break into the castle again, Hal said.
Both men laughed bitterly.
You lack not in enterprise or in heart, Captain, Big Daniel said, but that is madness.
Aberley agreed with him, and said in his deep, thoughtful voice,
If I thought there was even the poorest chance of success, I would gladly go alone. But think on it, good Duane. I do not mean merely the impossibility of winning our way into the castle armory. Say even that we succeeded in that, and that the store of powder we destroyed has since been replenished by shipments from Holland. Say that we were able to escape with some of it. How would we carry even a single keg back across the plains with Schroeder and his men pursuing us? This time we would not have the horses.
In his heart, Hal had known that it was madness, but he had hoped that even such a desperate and forlorn proposal might fire them to think of another plan. At last, Aberley broke the silence.
You spoke of a plan to find a ship. If you tell us that plan, Gondwani, then perhaps we can help you to bring it to pass.
Both men looked at him expectantly.
Where do you suppose the buzzard is at this very moment? Hal asked.
Aberley and Big Daniel looked startled. If my prayers have prevailed, he's roasting in hell, Daniel replied bitterly.
Hal looked at Aberley.
What do you think, Aberley? Where would you look for the buzzard? Somewhere out in the seven seas, wherever he smells gold or the promise of easy pickings, like the carrion bird for which he is named.
Yes, Hal clapped him on the shoulder.
But where might the smell of gold be strongest? Why did the buzzard buy Jiri and our other black shipmates at auction?
Aberley stared blankly at him. Then a slow smile spread over his wide, dark face.
Ha! Elephant Lagoon! He exclaimed.
Big Daniel boomed with excited laughter.
He scented the treasure from the Dutch galleons, and he thought our negro lads could lead him to it.
How far are we from Elephant Lagoon? Aberley asked.
By my reckoning, 300 sea miles.
The immensity of the distance silenced them.
Oh, it's a long tack, said Daniel. Without powder to defend ourselves on the way, or with which to fight the buzzard if we get there?
Aberley did not reply, but looked at Hal.
How long will the journey take us, Gondwani?
If we can make good 10 miles a day, which I doubt, perhaps a little over a month.
Will the buzzard still be there when we arrive? Or will he have given up his search and sailed away?
Aberley thought aloud.
Aye, Daniel muttered. And if he is gone, what will become of us then? We'd be marooned there forever.
Do you prefer to be marooned here, Master Daniel? Do you want to die of cold and starvation on this godforsaken mountain when winter comes around again?
They were quiet again.
Then Aberley said, I am ready to leave now. There is no other path open to us.
Aye, but what of Sir Henry's leg? Is it strong enough yet?
Give me another week, lads, and I'll walk the hind legs off all of you.
What do we do if we find the buzzard still roosted at Elephant Lagoon?
Daniel was not ready to agree so easily.
He has a crew of 100 well-armed ruffians, and if all of us survive the journey, we will be a dozen armed with swords alone.
That's fine odds, Hal laughed at him. I've seen you take on much worse, powder or no powder. We're off to find the buzzard. Are you with us or not, Master Daniel?
Of course I'm with you, Captain, Big Daniel was affronted. What made you think I was not?
That night, around the council fire, Hal explained the plan to the others. When he had finished, he looked at their somber faces in the firelight.
I will prevail on no man to come with us. Aberley, Daniel, and I are determined to go. But if any amongst you wishes to remain here in the mountains, we will leave half the store of weapons with you, including half the remaining gunpowder, and we will think no ill of you.
Are there any of you who wish to speak?
Yes, said Tsukina, without looking up from the food she was cooking. I go wherever you go.
Bravely spoken, princess, grinned Ned Tyler. And I go also.
Aye, said the other seamen in unison. We're all with you. Hal nodded his thanks to them and then looked at Althuda.
You have a woman and your son to think of, Althuda. What say you?
He could see the distress on the face of the little Svainchi as she suckled the baby at her breast. Her dark eyes were filled with doubts and misgivings. Althuda lifted her to her feet and led her away into the darkness. When they were alone, Saba spoke for all his band.
Althuda is our leader. He brought us out of captivity, and we cannot leave him and Svainchi alone in the wilderness to perish with the baby of cold and hunger. If Althuda goes, we go, but if he stays, we must stay with him.
I admire your resolve and your loyalty, Saba, said Hal.
They waited in silence, hearing Svainchi weeping with fear and indecision in the darkness.
Then, after a long while, Althuda led her back to the fire, his arm around her shoulders, and they took their places in the circle.
Svainchi fears not for herself but for the baby, he said. But she knows that our best chance will be with you, Sahal. We will come with you.
I would have mourned if your decision had been different, Althuda. Hal smiled with genuine pleasure. Together our chances are much increased. Now we must make our preparations and agree on the time when we will set out.
Sukina came from the fire to sit beside Hal and spoke out firmly.
Your leg will not be healed for at least another 5 days. I will not allow you to march upon it before then.
When the princess speaks, Abeli declared in his deep voice, only a foolish man does not listen.